Welcome to the second half of my two-part series on the islands of Hawaii. I highly recommend that before you listen to this episode, you check out the first half, which was published on April 9th. I have always been uncomfortable with symbols of privilege. Fancy clothes, flashy cards, expensive watches, that kind of thing. And I think that's partly why I have always felt a certain discomfort with the types of things that I associate with tourism, like cruise ships and big hotels. One day, even I walked through some of the giant hotels that line Waikiki Beach just to see what was there. The pools looked like something out of a movie, and I was struck by what was basically a pool-sized, king-sized daybed that guests could pay for by the hour. It wasn't more than 30 feet from the beach. But buying time on that bed wasn't just buying comfort, it was buying exclusivity. 10 minutes later, we were walking past the homeless encampment in the park near Ala Moana. I really didn't want to be that. As I said at the beginning of the first part of this essay, I didn't want to be a tourist. I wanted to be a traveler. Walk around anywhere in Hawaii and you're bound to find crowds of people lined up for the experiences they've heard about, even, as a complete surprise to this New England boy, hiking. Climbing the paved trails of Diamond Head in 2021 was a bit like standing in line at Disney World. Diamond Head was part of the package that people had bought, and by God, they wanted their money's worth. I, on the other hand, didn't want to keep buying and buying and buying all the time. One of the things that made me uncomfortable was the way that all of this packaging made this living, breathing place feel like a product, like a commodity that you might shop around for a good deal on. But probably the thing that made me most uncomfortable was the commodification of people. Diamond Head and Hanauma Bay and surf lessons at Waikiki weren't the only parts of the package. So was the luau and the hula. And something, to me, felt deeply wrong about buying a ticket to what felt like a circus show where people performed a kind of stylized Hawaiianness to people who knew almost nothing about its traditions or significance. I've a faded memory of an old Seinfeld routine where he says, people aren't traveling to interact with exotic people, they're traveling to interact with exotic clothing. I didn't want a performance. I wasn't looking for exotic clothes, exotic places, or exotic people. I wanted authenticity. Compare the luau, for example, with what most locals might actually do to hang out with their family and friends. After the sun goes down and most visitors scurry back to their hotels or to the crowded restaurants in Kalakaua Avenue, people show up after work with canopies and lawn chairs and barbecues and several metric tons of pasta salad. And they sit and they chat and they play music. And after being in Honolulu for some weeks, we'd gotten to know some of Jamie's friends and they invited us to join them down by Ala Moana. And the kids played in the water and the grown-ups sat in lawn chairs and talked and laughed. And it was one of my favorite experiences in Hawaii, and it was basically just a picnic. It felt a little bit like a laid-back 4th of July. This, I thought, was what I wanted, to see what Hawaii was really like, not a reflection of what I dreamed it would be from home. This is what I thought of as the quest of the traveler, and I feel very lucky to have had a lot of experiences like that one. But I have to admit that traveling in Hawaii has blurred the line between tourist and traveler, just like it did to the ones between native and visitor. On a different summer and a different island from that picnic, I was watching the sunset over the ocean from a pier, and across the water was just the kind of luau that made me squirm. Tables were set for 100 people on a lawn like a golf course. The kerosene smell of the tiki torches wafted over on the breeze, and on a stage under a row of hot lights were the dancers. We were waiting for something, I don't remember quite what, so we sat in the pier and watched. And to my surprise, instead of thinking about colonialism and stereotypes, I ended up thinking about my daughter's performances at her local youth theater. There on that stage were some people who had worked hard to master and synchronize a complicated and graceful dance. There was their accompaniment who had mastered traditional drums and instruments. This was not the dance that people may have done on these shores 300 years ago, but it didn't change the fact that it was actually marvelous and difficult. The type of thing I'd be proud of if I could do or if my kids had mastered. And if you look into the history of the hula, you'll find that it has always been in flux, just like tango or breakdancing. Styles come and go. the meaning and clothing change, and yes, they were influenced by foreign audiences. But what dance isn't influenced by its audience? So I found myself sitting there on the pier, being a tourist, and it was delightful. And when I looked back across the water at all the people sitting at their outdoor tables, I realized that most of the difference between me and them was my own pretense. Those folks had come here because they wanted adventure. They wanted to discover quiet and pristine places. They wanted to feel that they were in some place strikingly different from home and to learn about that place and have memories of the beautiful things they had seen. They didn't think they were tourists. They thought they were travelers too. What made me believe that I was so different? Traveler was something I identified as, in part, I think, to absolve myself from my own impact on a place. If I wasn't a tourist, I didn't feel as responsible for all the sprawl and crowding and kitsch. But traveler or not, I still paid my share to burn the carbon on the plane. The word tourist comes from the French tour, an old word for turning something on a lathe. It's a word for people who go in circles. And where do any of us really go except there and back again? We are all on this planet for a quick tour before the atoms of our bodies return to the cycles from which they came. Now, I tend to think that we are all tourists, every single one of us. And as for authenticity, I think I've learned two things. First is that I don't need to worry about it. The world will be authentic no matter what I do or where I go. In fact, it's kind of hard to escape. Even on the wildest adventure, you still need groceries, you still do laundry, you brush your teeth, and your kids get sick. In an apocryphal quote attributed to Thomas Merton, when asked if he had seen the real Asia, he responded, "Well, it's all real as far as I can see." And second, the authenticity of our experience doesn't come from where you go or what you do or how much or how little you pay for it. Authenticity is something you bring to an experience, not something the experience brings to you. So where am I now? I don't really have any answers. Turns out all the old ideas I had about freedom and entitlement, native and visitor, tourist and traveler, weren't really as helpful as they seemed. But I feel like I have better questions than I did when I started. And the foremost travel question on my mind these days is, how can I travel in a way that will both make me a better person and make the people and places I travel to happy to have had me come? I've made mistakes in that regard before, and I'm sure I will make them again. Forgive me if I happen to make them in your backyard. But despite this uncertainty, I can tell you my current working hypothesis for how to travel in a way that I aspire to. Here it is in 6 parts. First, stay longer and go slower. Try not to rent a car, even if it does make things easier. I mean, why go to a place only to spend my time running from one thing to the next? So my intention is to try and quiet the part of myself that wants to collect places and experiences so that instead I can be with them like I might be with a new friend. Number 2, buy local. In the past, I've often tried to travel as cheaply as I could. Spending a little money, though, is the bare minimum I can do to give back to a place. So I will try to remember that good deals often come from economies of scale, and those are the types of things that corporate hotel chains leverage. I hope that I can think of paying the tourist prices in the marketplace as the price of admission for having a place that is a place. Instead of trying to hunt for deals, I hope that I can pay happily. Third, I hope that I can welcome others to my own places, give my fellow tourists the benefit of the doubt that they are trying to be good guests, and to think of my own gaffes before I roll my eyes. Number 4, be clean and be quiet. Especially as an American traveling abroad, erring on this side might counterbalance our well-deserved reputation for being otherwise. That said, I also know that etiquette is a moving target. It looks different on Bourbon Street from the way it looks in the Sistine Chapel. And there is going to be no easy rule of thumb, so I will try to pay attention and also to forgive myself when I inevitably transgress. Number 5, I intend to be curious about the ordinary. As Rolf Pott says, what is travel if it is not an attitude of friendly interest in people and places and things? And it is this attitude that makes a person an explorer in the truest sense. And sixth, to be thankful with all my heart to the places and people that I visit. In Hawaii, the first word of Hawaiian you learn after aloha is mahalo. It means thanks and admiration and esteem and respect. And everyone, no matter their first language, uses it all the time, as if the whole state is committed to gratitude. And so I'd like to say mahalo now to the people and the place of Hawaii. It is one of the greatest treasures of this world. I was so lucky to visit, and I have learned so much from you. And I'd especially like to extend mahalo nui loa, my deepest appreciation, to our good friend Jamie. Without her, it wouldn't have been possible at all for us to travel to those beautiful islands and to experience them as deeply and as fully as we did. By way of parting, I would like to end this episode with the story of the Hokulea. It is the story of travelers who I think have done it right. You might have seen the movie Moana, about a girl who dreams of sailing on the Pacific Ocean. In the movie, she learns the secrets of wayfinding, of figuring out where she is in the ocean, even if she is so far away from land that she can't see it, even if there are no landmarks to be seen. In the movie, Moana's wayfinding seems magical, but that's not a surprise. I mean, unrealistic magical things happen in movies all the time. Moana is a made-up story. But what if I told you that wayfinding isn't made up? And it isn't magic. It's real. Wayfinding in the open ocean, even one as enormous as the Pacific, is a kind of magic that people can actually learn to do. Thousands of years ago, people who lived near the Pacific Ocean learned the secrets of wayfinding. They sailed across the world's biggest ocean, and they learned to find many of the islands there. These people became so skilled at wayfinding that they could navigate directly between islands that seemed like tiny specks in all that vast ocean wilderness. But over time, that knowledge was lost. Just like with Moana's people in the movie, the people living on some of those islands forgot how to find their way across the ocean without getting lost. This was true for the people on the islands of Hawaii. About 50 years ago, no living Hawaiian knew the ancient techniques. But just like Moana, there were people who dreamed of trying. In the 1970s, a group of them built a ship like the ones that had carried their ancestors to Hawaii. They called it the Hokulea, the Star of Gladness, and they began to look for someone who might still know the secrets of how to navigate with it. In a far-off group of islands, they found some people who did, but there were only six of them, perhaps the last six people in all the world who still practiced this ancient tradition. The wayfinders of these other islands had carefully guarded their secrets, and most of them did not want to teach them to these strangers, all that is but one, named Mau Pilug, who worried that if they didn't share that knowledge, it would be lost forever. So Mau agreed to teach them what he knew. Under Mau's leadership, this group of Hawaiians took the Hokulea out into the ocean to see if they could recreate the kind of voyage that their ancestors had taken centuries before. Their goal was to find their way to the island of Tahiti, a single tiny island in the vast ocean. Even being off by a few miles would mean that they could miss it without even seeing it. And they sailed for more than a month out of the sight of any land, probably the first voyage of its kind in over 600 years. On June 24th, 1976, the Hokulea arrived in Papeete Harbor in Tahiti. About 17,000 people were there to greet them. As the ship touched the sand, people ran into the water. So many of them climbed on the ship that they nearly sank it. Celebrations took place all across Tahiti, for the Tahitians were also a people who had lost the wayfinding tradition of their ancestors. It was a proud moment, not just for the people who sailed the Hokulea, but for people all across the Pacific. They had revived an ancient tradition that had been nearly forgotten, and today there are dozens of people across the Pacific who are keeping the knowledge of wayfinding alive. The people who piloted the Hokulea inspired me to a new vision of what it means to travel. I want to travel far, but I want to do it in a way that makes something old new again. I want to be humble enough to learn. I want to bring hope to the places I go. I want to greet the people I find there as my kin, and I want to deserve the welcome that I receive. If you found something valuable in iHeart This, please support us with a short review on whatever platform you're listening. iHeart This is written, edited, and produced by me, Ben Lord. Our logo was designed by Brian Imaro Cribbs. Our website is iHeartThisPodcast.com. You can email me at ben@iHeartThisPodcast.com, and I'd love to hear from you. And also, we're on Facebook at iHeartThisPodcast. Thank you so much for listening. And as always, be kind and be curious and be thankful.